All right, so we're back, and we've got episode 60, which, of course, is a bit of a mini milestone episode, I suppose. So I thought we'd make it a special dedication to the theme of 60 itself. Got to be honest, originally I was going to go with Chuck Bednarik. He was an NFL great, Pennsylvania native, and combat vet, two-way player. He had a lot of ties to 60. That was his number. That was also the year when he knocked out Frank Gifford in that infamous hit. But there was something else that I had to place in front of concrete Chuck Bednarik, and it happened in 60, as in 1960. Yes, the year 1960 in baseball, that's the year that the underdog Pittsburgh Pirates took down the dynastic New York Yankees in what was a stunning and a weird seven-game World Series. So the Pirates had a great team. You know, they had Dick Groden and Bill Mazeroski and Harvey Haddix and Vern Law, Dick Stewart. They had a young Roberto Clemente. They were coached by Danny Murtaugh. But the Yankees, I mean, they were just loaded. They had Mickey Mantle, and they had Yogi Berra, and they had Whitey Ford and Roger Maris. And their manager was someone that you probably heard of, Casey Stengel. So the series, it did go to seven games, of course. What was really strange about this, or one aspect that was strange, the Yankees absolutely destroyed the Pirates in the three games they won. The Yankees scores of their winning three games were 16-3, 10-0, and 12-0. But, you know, the Pirates scratched three wins out to get to a Game 7. And Game 7 turned out to be one of the most thrilling games in World Series history and definitely the most thrilling finish in the history of baseball. So, of course, you had Mazeroski in the bottom of the ninth, Game 7, scores tied 9-9. He hits a home run over the left field wall off of Ralph Terry. And by the way, who was the left fielder that the ball sailed over the head of? It was Yogi Berra. He wasn't catching. He was playing left field. So the Pirates, you know, they were outmanned by the star power of the Yankees. They were outscored. They were outhit. But in the end, the Pirates won the series. David slayed Goliath in that magical year of 1960. That would be Casey Stengel's last World Series. The Yankees soon sent him packing into retirement. He made that famous remark after that World Series that he would never make the mistake of turning 70 again. And another weird thing about that series, the MVP was not from the winning Pirates. It went to Bobby Richardson of the Yankees. That's the only time it's ever happened when it came to a World Series MVP being awarded to a player for the losing team. And another cool thing about the 60 World Series was that before the mid-70s or so, the TV stations that broadcast all these sporting events, they didn't archive those games. They basically recorded over them to save film. It was sort of a cost-saving measure. So a lot of these older games have no prior sort of archive that was preserved where you can watch them again. And that was the case for all the games in the 60 World Series, except for Game 7. There is a copy, a recording of Game 7. And the reason there's one, it's a pretty cool story. Bing Crosby, at the time, was a part owner of the Pirates. He loved watching the games, but he was very superstitious and he was out of country. So he owned another financial interest in a company that had some proprietary technology to record events on television, that type of thing. And he had the Game 7 recorded, and he figured that he would watch the game only if the Pirates won. So the Pirates ended up winning, he watches the game, and then he puts this tape or archive of the game away in his wine cellar where it's forgotten about for decades and decades and decades. And then around 2009, whoever's in charge of his estate, they find this recording to Game 7, and now you're able to view it. I had a chance to see that when they aired it on regional TV not long ago, and that game flies by. You think about how painful it is watching a baseball game today and how long it takes. That game went by very quickly, very entertaining. So sort of a cool story about how the filming of that game has been preserved almost by accident. Another cool thing were the announcers for the series. They split between Mel Allen and Bob Prince, who were the play-by-play announcers for the Yankees and Pirates, respectively. So for Game 7, Bob Prince took the front half of the game, and then Mel Allen announced the latter half of the game, which is another cool thing. And then the last thing about the 60 World Series, when we're dedicating this, Bronx Tale, the movie. I love that movie. But if you recall the kid talking to the gangster, Chaz Palminteri, who played the gangster, the kid was saying how he hated Bill Mazeroski because he made Mickey Mantle cry in that World Series. And the gangster says, "Mickey Mantle, is that what you're upset about? He makes $100,000 a year. How much does your old man make driving a bus? If your dad can't afford to pay the rent, right, he says, go see what Mickey Mantle tells you." That's what the gangster told him. Sort of gave him some real world advice. Mickey Mantle doesn't care about you. So always, every time I think of the 60 World Series and Mazeroski and Mantle, I think of A Bronx Tale as well. So episode 60, dedicated to the 1960 world champion Pittsburgh Pirates. I want to take a little bit of a different tack today with episode 60 and invest the time for the episode to talk about a topic that looks on the surface to be something that's really specialized and nuanced, sort of a detail within sort of regulatory reporting requirements for public companies. But it's something that will have massive implications for everybody across all segments of the economy. So it's something that's going to affect you and I. And the subject is the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC's, proposed rule on the enhancement and standardization of climate-related disclosures for investors. Now, think about that title, the enhancement and standardization of climate-related disclosures for investors. Doesn't that title sound great? You know, enhancement, that's a good thing. Standardization, I like that. Benefiting or being for investors, that's a noble goal or objective. So then why should someone be worried about what appears to be a very nuanced topic with a very sort of interesting, worthy title? Well, we'll get to that in a minute after we get some background laid out first. So first, let's summarize the terminology for how companies and industries report greenhouse gas emissions and CO2 emissions and carbon footprints. That's something that's prevalent everywhere you look today, and that's really what this new proposed rule from the SEC ultimately wants to speak to. So there are three levels, or what is referred to as scopes, for carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. And let's walk through them and add them up. So scope one, that's the most basic. Those are direct emissions of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases that occur from sources that are controlled or owned by the company. So do you have a boiler that's making emissions of carbon dioxide? Do you own combustion engine vehicles that have tailpipe emissions? Think of this as the emissions from the assets that you have title to and that you completely control. So that's sort of, again, the simplest of the three. That's scope one. Scope two emissions are those that come from the energy that the company purchases off-site. So it could be from electricity purchases, or if you're using steam heat, or if you've got cooling capacity for something like a data center. And scope two emissions, they physically occur at the facility where they're generated, at the power plant or wherever you're generating the cooling or the steam heat. But under this methodology, they're accounted for, they're counted in the end user company's greenhouse gas or carbon dioxide equivalent emissions because they're a result of the organization's or the company's energy use. So that's scope two emissions under the methodology for carbon accounting. Now, scope three emissions, that's where things get interesting. These are going to be the greenhouse gas or CO2 emissions that are from the activities and assets not owned or directly controlled by the company, but that the company indirectly impacts in its value chain. Think of scope three emissions for one company being also the scopes one or two emissions for other companies upstream or downstream of it. And scope three emissions, they need to account for both upstream and downstream supply chain emissions. So what it took to make your assets and company and what your products emit once unleashed on the market or the customers or the consumers. So it works both ways, upstream and downstream. And an example I think would help here to illustrate what scope three is. An electric vehicle, right, if you think about an EV, it does not have tailpipe emissions, which for a company that owns a fleet of electric vehicles would tally as zero emissions for scope one. For that asset of an electric vehicle that it directly owns and controls. But then for scope two emissions, that company would need to think about where the electricity is coming from to charge the electric vehicle when it's not in use. Was it coming from coal-fired power plants or solar or something else? And that answer to that question is going to impact the scope two emissions for the company because it involves the emissions tied to the energy that company uses or purchases to run its business and assets. Here, the specific example, right, being the energy used to charge its EV fleet. Then things get really interesting when it comes to the company's scope three emissions that are tied to the supply chain of the electric vehicle fleet. What is the electric vehicle made from, you know, particularly its battery? Well, all kinds of metals and materials and rare earth elements that have to be mined in faraway lands and it have to be refined and processed. And that mining and processing, they are done on the back of carbon power, especially in places like China, Russia, and Africa, where much of that is going to be done. And worse yet, right, some of this mining, as in the case of cobalt, is done with child slave labor, but that's a critically important but entirely separate issue for another episode that we can talk about. So then they must be manufactured, right? Once they're processed, mined and processed, they're going to have to be manufactured in factories, the components of an electric vehicle, that are typically going to use carbon-based power to run the factories. And then the stuff, once manufactured, it's going to need to be transported to where the company operates, whether that's by plane, train, ship, truck, or combination of those, all of which are going to run in some way on carbon too. So you start to get the picture. The Scope 3 footprint of the company with the electric vehicle fleet, it's very large, it's very complicated, and it's likely going to dwarf the Scope 1 and 2 emissions for that company. In this example that I just gave you, it's pretty much the norm when it comes to Scopes 1 and 2 versus Scope 3 emissions. Scope 3 emissions are typically going to be the bulk of a company's cumulative greenhouse gas and carbon dioxide emissions. And often, Scope 3 emissions are going to make Scopes 1 and 2 look minuscule by comparison. So I'll give you another example, this one a real-world one. Let's talk about Apple. Apple itself says that it produced 47,430 tons of greenhouse gas emissions in a recent year. That's their number. That's about the same greenhouse gas emissions as a single Boeing plane. But now here's the dirty little secret. Those 47,000 plus tons, guess what? They exclude Scope 3 emissions. And when you add in Scope 3 emissions from the production of Apple computers and smartphones by its suppliers, and then their transportation of those products, and then the use of those products by Apple customers, which, you know, use electricity, use energy, and have emissions. In other words, when you look at the upstream and downstream supply chain emissions, the number of greenhouse gas emissions for Apple goes to 22 million tons. That's Apple's estimate, by the way. And that is 475 times as large as its reported Scopes 1 and 2 emissions. So a great real-world illustration of what we were just talking about. And then companies who decide to report a fraction, or worse yet, decide not to report Scope 3 emissions at all, they can reconfigure their supply chains and their processes to make those emissions go away on their greenhouse gas reporting and accounting. But from an atmospheric perspective and from a climate change perspective, the planet's no better off. The CO2 and the carbon, or the greenhouse gas emissions and the carbon footprints, they're still large, they're still being emitted. They're now just moved off balance sheet, so to speak, for the public company. It's a form of greenwashing at the end of the day, and it can be misleading as well. And incidentally, the company I work for, we've not reported Scope 3 emissions for the last 2 years. We did report Scopes 1 and 2, but why didn't we? For the reasons that we laid out just now and that we'll continue to lay out in this episode of The Far Middle. If a level playing field can be established, we'd gladly match our end-to-end life cycle emissions, including Scope 3, against any company from any industry. But you need, right, those level playing field rules to be established first. And let's take another example of how subjectivity in how a company reports Scope 3, how that can matter. So let's use the example in this instance of Amazon. The company voluntarily reports its Scope 3 emissions, which is great, but it only reports the Scope 3 emissions for its own products, like Kindles. It does not report Scope 3 emissions for all the products it procures and delivers across its massive complex. So when you assess this approach, Amazon's own products, they account for only about 1% of its sales, which means 99% of its sales, when it comes to Scope 3 emissions, are not being reported by Amazon. So details in financial accounting matter. We know that. Everybody knows that, right, when it comes to public companies. And now we're learning that details in carbon accounting also are going to matter. Okay, now with that background information and that backdrop and that primer on how carbon and greenhouse gas emissions reporting works with Scopes 1 through 3, let's shift to that proposed SEC rule. Again, the title of which is the Enhancement and Standardization of Climate-Related Disclosures for Investors. The theme, once again, details are going to matter for the proposed rule. And the proposed rule from the SEC was a nice, brief, and crystallized 500-plus pages of bureaucratic babble. A simple, altruistic title, but unbelievably obtuse and complex reality. That's government, I suppose, and our regulatory state norms these days. And I have to admit that my initial thought was to embrace the proposed rule as an opportunity, right, for companies like mine and industries like domestic energy to show that our commitments are backed up by tangible actions. And I also thought this would be a great opportunity to demonstrate how a company like mine stacks up against other companies using verifiable and comparable data and showcase our sustainable business model in action. You know, to me, this proposed rule was a chance to have everyone show their cards in a transparent and consistent manner across companies and industries to then allow investors in the capital markets to see who had the winning formulas and who did not when it comes to carbon intensity and carbon footprint. But then I had to give a read to the details of the proposed rule, and therein I discovered the devil. Unfortunately, the proposal, it falls short of establishing the kind of level playing field necessary to give the public what it deserves. And instead, it's injecting confusion and undermining investors' access to truly comparative greenhouse gas and carbon dioxide emissions data. It's important, I think, that investors receive adequate info to understand the full scope of a company's end-to-end life cycle emissions profile. In other words, it scopes 1 through 3 emissions. All companies, not just some, a standardized life cycle emissions reporting standard will show in the end that no business activity is without carbon emissions in some way, shape, or form. Now, I hinted that there were a few major flaws of this proposed SEC rule, and the first major flaw was that it fell short on its primary mission of fairness. The rule does not implement standardization to all public companies when reporting these greenhouse gas emissions. And part of the SEC's mission is fairness, which is defined, they define fairness as treating investors, market participants, and others fairly and in accordance with the law. Yes, the SEC rightfully strives to govern market participants through the development and the adoption and the enforcement of rules that ensure equal and fair treatment for all involved. But the proposal, this proposed rule, it fails to live up to those virtues. And the word standardization suggests establishment of a consistent and a level playing field through which market participants, companies, will provide investors with standardized information regarding, you know, how the business practices potentially contribute to climate-related impacts. But to be truly standardized and really transparent, data are going to have to be unfiltered, independently verifiable, and complete for all companies, all participants. The proposal, as it's currently drafted, it falls short of achieving any of those, which is, of course, a big problem. And an example of this type of a shortcoming in the proposed rule, it's how it defines Scope 3 downstream emissions. And that's defined as emissions that include the use of registrants products, transportation of products, end-of-life treatment and sold products, and investments made by the registrant. Now, what does this definition really mean in practical application? You know, is an electric vehicle manufacturer required to disclose the expected greenhouse gas emissions from the energy consumed to operate these vehicles over their lifespan, including, right, the composition of the power grid that they use to power them and to charge them? And are they required to disclose the environmental impacts of suppliers and the subcontractors mining all those metals and minerals and elements around the world? How are these materials processed, and how might electric vehicle components be manufactured? It's less than clear, which means the answer is that it's probably not going to be reported. And a clearer definition is needed for investors to truly compare the emissions of that electric vehicle manufacturer and electric vehicle itself to the greenhouse gas emissions of a vehicle powered by gasoline or by diesel or by natural gas or by any other fuel. So how would one compare two different electric vehicle manufacturers with vastly different supply chains or with vastly different greenhouse gas profiles and environmental scores? One can only know this by understanding the greenhouse gas footprint of mining the metals and the minerals and the elements, the greenhouse gas emissions associated with transportation logistics, the greenhouse gas emissions from charging the electric vehicle, right? Do you use blended emissions from a power grid consisting of different sources of generation, whether it's coal or solar or wind? And then the greenhouse gas emissions from transporting and disposing of the electric vehicle at the end of its useful life. So it's way more complicated to accurately report these emissions across scopes 1 through 3 than what the rule apparently, in terms of how it's currently drafted, is anticipating. Now, another big problem or major flaw of this SEC proposed rule is that it runs the risk of misinforming investors despite the goals of improving accuracy and transparency. So think about a utility company that has both natural gas generation capacity and renewable generation, wind or solar capacity in its makeup. If, as contemplated by the rule as it's currently written, Scope 3 data of emissions, they can be aggregated for the full company, and it wouldn't be clear on the face of the disclosure whether there are significant emissions associated with the upstream activities attributable to the renewable generation capacity side of the company's business. So if you give in and you assume that popular but flawed notion that renewables are carbon free, right, when they're really not on a scopes 1 through 3 basis, a potential investor could inadvertently attribute all of the scope 3 emissions of this utility to the natural gas generation in its portfolio rather than to the actual sources. And in doing so, you're going to compromise the commission's goal of standardization and improved transparency. And then you can sort of take this further. If you think about the end users of that electricity that this utility company would be generating, those end users, they could basically say that they are carbon free because they purchase 100% renewable energy to run their operations. But what that overly simplistic view fails to account for, right, it's the carbon footprint of the value chain of that unit of electricity coming from wind or solar. So you get back into the scope 3 issue once again, and what looks to be on its face is carbon free under a scope 2 for that company that's buying the electricity, in reality may be something very different than zero carbon or carbon free. And then without a mandate to disclose the underlying data across the entire value chain in a standardized fashion, a company or these companies under these examples, they can continue to claim that they're carbon free without a verifiable method for an investor to test that claim or to compare that company's claim against others. So the proposal allows companies to continue making claims that could legitimately be labeled as what I would call greenwashing. In true standardization and transparency, they're going to have to provide the investor with an accurate and disaggregated view of the complete picture. Complete picture being scopes 1, 2, and 3, greenhouse gas emissions, not just parts of the picture that might distort the reality. Otherwise, an investor may assume the two greenhouse gas emission disclosures can be compared on an apples-to-apples basis. So there's still a lot of work to do to ensure a standard approach to reporting that reveals the true and the transparent impact of a registrant's greenhouse gas emissions across the entire value chain and full life cycle of a product or service, which includes the raw materials and the logistics and the product's utilization or use, and ultimately the retirement or the disposal of that product when its useful life is concluded. Now, the biggest problem that I've got, the biggest flaw that I see with the proposed SEC climate disclosure rule, it's the use of those squishy terms of material and significant. They pop up in this rule. And those words allow subjectivity in reporting emissions data and the assumptions behind them. So it's another wide open door to run through if greenwashing is a company's aim. And that's not good if one's looking for transparency and consistency and standardization. So the number of exceptions and qualifiers that's included in the proposal with respect to scope 3 emissions reporting, it alarms me, frankly, and it really makes me wonder. For example, a section of the proposal requires disclosure of scope 3 emissions only if quote-unquote material. And more granular disclosure is required for any categories of scope 3 emissions that are, quote, significant to the registrant or the company. So the phrase is material, right, significant. That's going to allow or require companies to make subjective determinations about whether and how to disclose scope 3 emissions, and that's going to lead to major misleading information, inconsistent information, and potentially some major greenwashing. And then there's also an exemption in the rules for reporting that's provided to smaller filers or smaller companies, and that mandatory scope 3 disclosures are going to be there for companies that have previously adopted emissions reduction targets that include scope 3 emissions. So the resulting information is going to become very difficult under the rule as it's currently written to compare from company to company. And each ton, when you think about this, each ton of carbon dioxide that enters the atmosphere, it's going to have the same impact regardless of whether it came from a significant source under the rule or any other. And whether those emissions are disclosed should not be left to the emitter or the company's sole discretion. So when you combine these exceptions and these qualifiers with the ability of public companies to use estimates for scope 3 emissions, as opposed to scope 1 and 2, where you have to have third-party sort of audit or attestation of them, or worse yet, you can use ranges using unnamed assumptions that only the company itself can set and knows, the results are going to be inconsistent, wide-ranging, and potentially unreliable reporting. So the stated goals of standardization and transparency, they're awesome, but they're going to be frustrated as the rule is currently proposed by the SEC, and investors are not going to benefit from these varying data standards or the subjective methodologies that these companies are inevitably going to choose to employ to probably paint emissions data in the most positive light possible, even if that picture is not going to be an accurate reflection of reality. So in the end, we don't need new rules that are going to create more confusion and create less clarity. Life is tough enough these days. Although others have been raising legitimate concerns with this proposed rule, such as the cost of complying with it and the reliability of the data and the potential for competitive harm, my concern, it's more fundamental. It's ensuring that the proposal and the rule as it's currently proposed is consistent with the SEC's noble mission and values in providing standardized and transparent disclosures to investors and treating all public companies fairly and equally. And left unaltered, this proposed rule is counterproductive to the SEC's well-intentioned goals of standardization and transparency. Investors are going to be confused, and certain companies and the public at large will bear the consequences. So the proposed climate rules, they're attempting to morph what is an ambiguous voluntary reporting framework that we've got today into an involuntary compliance framework without first addressing the necessary standardization to ensure a consistent and an accurate and a transparent level playing field across public companies and across the capital markets. So capital can end up being misallocated as a result, and appropriate standardization of climate-related disclosures should be in place to ensure that capital allocation decisions are made with accurate, transparent, and consistent data when it comes to cumulative life cycle greenhouse gas emissions. This is not that. This rule is not that. And without some serious modification, the proposed rule is going to further enable some to perpetuate myths about their true life cycle greenhouse gas emissions, and it'll erode the public's trust in our capital markets. We don't need either one of those. So I know a lot of this might have been very detailed and intense, a little bit different than what we typically tackle on far middle podcast episodes, but I felt it was so important, such a big issue affecting, as I said, everyone, because everybody in some way, shape, or form is affected and has a carbon footprint. I wanted to spend enough time to cover that with the constant listeners. So let's wrap this special edition of the Far Middle. This proposed rule on climate from the SEC for public companies, again, it's crucial to everybody out there for three reasons. First, every company on Earth has an environmental impact and a carbon footprint when you assess its activities on a scopes 1-3 basis and on a cradle-to-grave basis. Greenwashing or outsourcing carbon footprint in your upstream or downstream supply chain and not reporting all the associated scope 3 emissions isn't going to change that. Second, a rule that implements accuracy and consistency and transparency and standardization across all companies, that's going to be a good rule. And that is the golden potential of the proposed rule. And it should be the desired end game that would serve the capital markets and investors. And then third, the rule is currently laid out in its details. It falls far short of its golden potential and would likely increase confusion and create misallocation of greenhouse gas dependent capital and investing decisions. Those are the exact opposite objectives of what the Securities and Exchange Commission is after and what its mission is. So let's make sure the SEC gets this rule right. The end goals and the mission are the right ones. But let's be honest with ourselves and the public. Instead of opening up more avenues to greenwash, that may benefit some individual companies and industries, but at least the public and the investor and the environment holding the bag. If we're going to do this, let's not do it half. Well, you know what I mean. Let's just say we should do this right. Talk next week.